From Pacifica Network, this is Democracy Now! Voting has begun in the state of Florida. Already problems have emerged. We'll look today at intimidation and suppression of voting in Florida and around the country. But first, we'll go to Haiti, where scores of people have died in political violence over the last few weeks, on top of the thousands who died as a result of the hurricane. In the last few days, another prominent priest has been arrested. We'll speak with Congressmember Maxine Waters.
The destabilization of Haiti has been caused by the coup d'etat and the removal of Aristide. Again, it's just like Iraq. They didn't have any post-war planning.
All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. More than 100 people are believed to have been killed or injured north of Baghdad after an Iraqi National Guard headquarters came under heavy mortar attack early today. This according to a report by the BBC. The attack came in a town 25 miles north of Baghdad. Since the start of the Muslim holy month of Ramadan began, 13 Iraqi police officers had already been killed before today's attacks. Meanwhile, New York Times is estimating at least 208 Iraqis died last week, including two journalists. 22-year-old photographer Karam Hussein, who worked for the European Press Agency, was shot dead by four masked gunmen in Mosul. And television reporter Dina Mohammed Hassan, who works for the Kurdish TV station Al-Hara, was killed in a drive-by shooting. The Committee to Protect Journalists estimates 46 media workers have died since the U.S. invaded Iraq. And yesterday, an Australian journalist, John Martinkus, was released after being held hostage for 24 hours in Iraq. Martinkus said yesterday, quote, "I was treated, well treated. I was not hurt and treated with respect once they established my credentials as an independent journalist who did not support the occupation." And earlier today, the humanitarian group CARE International announced its head of operations in Iraq has been kidnapped in Baghdad. Margaret Hassan has been working for the charity for more than a decade and has lived in Iraq for 30 years. In Britain, Prime Minister Tony Blair is coming under heavy criticism for planning to agree with a request from the Bush administration to dispatch hundreds of British troops just south of Baghdad to aid U.S. forces. Opponents of the plan said the move is a ploy by President Bush to demonstrate ahead of the November 2nd election that there is international support for the Iraq war. The redeployment of British troops would also free up U.S. soldiers for an all-out assault on Fallujah. In related news, the Australian government has turned down a request by the United Nations to send more troops to Iraq to protect UN personnel. Instead, Australia offered to train a contingent of Fijian soldiers for the job. This comes as the Washington Post is reporting the scheduled January elections in Iraq could be in jeopardy because of a shortage of election experts from the United Nations. The UN currently has about 35 officials in Iraq, and only four or five are election experts. Originally, the UN's top election expert estimated 270 UN advisors would be needed to oversee credible elections. In Afghanistan, the UN had over 250 election experts in the lead-up to last week's vote there. The United Nations has said it can't send more workers in until the security situation improves. The U.S. had planned to mobilize troops from Georgia and Fiji to protect UN workers, but the force hasn't been formed yet. A new Pentagon survey has found less than half of U.S. Army reservists in Iraq felt their unit was, quote, well prepared for its wartime mission. In addition, the survey found the percentage of reservists and National Guard soldiers who plan to stay in the military fell 10% from a year before. The Sinclair Broadcast Group has fired its Washington bureau chief after he publicly criticized the company's decision to air a documentary critical of John Kerry just days before the November 2nd election. The decision came after the journalist, John Lieberman, told the Baltimore Sun that the film was, quote, biased political propaganda with clear intentions to sway this election. For me, it's not about right or left, he said. It's about what's right or wrong in news coverage this close to an election. Following his firing, Lieberman said, quote, they're using the news to drive their political agenda. I don't think it served the public interest, the public trust. Lieberman's dismissal came on the same day the company's stock value plunged nearly 8%. Human Rights Watch yesterday issued a 135-page report accusing Israel of systematically violating international law by destroying the homes of 16,000 Palestinians in southern Gaza. Over the past 4 years, the group estimates 10% of the Palestinians in Rafah have had their homes destroyed. Human Rights Watch is calling on the United States and European countries to demand Israel pay reparations for victims or compensation to Palestinians who lost their homes. In addition, the report calls on Caterpillar Inc., the U.S.-based company that supplies Israel with the powerful bulldozers, to suspend sales of equipment used in illegal demolitions. In Syracuse, the trial of an Iraqi-American doctor charged with sending money to Iraq in defiance of the U.S. sanctions is set to begin today. Rafil Dafir is the only person to be criminally prosecuted or jailed for violating the sanctions. He's been detained for the past 20 months awaiting trial. On Friday, Dafir's defense team was dealt a setback when the presiding judge ruled attorneys could not argue that Dafir was being selectively prosecuted because he was a Muslim. In addition, the doctor's attorneys will be barred from delving into the government's original motives for investigating him. When he was first detained, government officials hinted he had ties to terrorists, but no terrorism charges were ever filed. Instead, the government ended up charging him with violating the sanctions as well as Medicare fraud and tax evasion. Police yesterday arrested 21 protesters at the Bush-Cheney campaign headquarters in Virginia, participating in a demonstration organized by the AIDS advocacy group ACT UP and Housing Works. Robert Cadera of Housing Works said, quote, we're here to protest the failures of the Bush administration's AIDS policies. There are 40,000 new infections per year in the United States, more people uninsured, more people who need housing. Meanwhile, last week in Jacksonville, Oregon, riot police shot projectiles known as pepper balls at a crowd of protesters who'd gathered to protest a campaign appearance by President Bush. The pepper balls have been described like paintballs filled with cayenne pepper. At least one protester, 65-year-old Richard Swaney, was knocked down after being shot by police. One mother told the Associated Press she'd been pushed by police as she held her 6-year-old daughter. The woman, Carrie Dewan Bunton, said, quote, nobody was being violent. We were out in the streets so cars could go by. We were being loud, but I never knew that was against the law. In election news, the Supreme Court ordered a lower court to sort out Texas's controversial redistricting of congressional districts. Republican legislators redrew the state's congressional map last year in a way that will likely give the GOP 5 or 6 additional seats. While the Supreme Court's decision gives Democrats another chance to get the redistricting plan scrapped, it will not be in time to affect the November 2nd election. Republicans are expected to easily retain control of the House after November 2nd, in part because of the redistricting in Texas. And this news from Burma. The nation's military regime has forced out its prime minister and placed him under house arrest. The ousted prime minister, General Khin Nguyen, is reportedly being charged with corruption. He was seen as one of the less hardline voices in the military junta. His removal is expected to further delay the stalled reconciliation process with the opposition, led by Nobel Peace Prize laureate Aung San Suu Kyi. Soane here on Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report, a Haitian singer who has been in jail in Haiti for months. I'm Amy Goodman. South Africa has rejected accusations that it let ousted Haitian President Jean-Bertrand Aristide incite violence in Haiti from his place in exile. Haiti's unelected Prime Minister, Gerard Latortue, accused the South African President Thabo Mbeki Sunday of allowing Aristide to direct a violent campaign in Haiti from South Africa. Aristide was ousted in February in what he calls a modern-day kidnapping in the service of a coup d'etat backed by the United States. South African Deputy Foreign Minister Aziz Pahad responded by saying, quote, South Africa cannot be used as a scapegoat for failure by the interim Haitian authorities to bring about peace and stability. Haiti's been rocked by violence since September 30th, after demonstrators took to the streets demanding the return of President Aristide and condemning political persecution of his Lavalas political party. The protests came on the 10th anniversary of Aristide's first return from exile in 1994 after the three-year coup. Police reportedly opened fire on the unarmed demonstrators. At least 55 people have been killed since then. The violence comes just weeks after storms and flooding left more than 3,000 Haitians dead last month. Top Lavalas leaders and activists have also been placed under house arrest in recent weeks. On Saturday, three Haitian politicians allied with Aristide surrendered to police Saturday after barricading themselves in a radio station for 6 hours. Earlier in the week, Catholic priest Father Gerard Jean-Just was arrested as he was feeding almost 600 children from his church in Port-au-Prince. The government accused him of inciting violence. Haitians took to the streets in Port-au-Prince and Miami to protest the arrest. In a minute, we'll go to Haiti to speak with one of Father Gerard Jean-Just's lawyers. But first, we turn to U.S. Congressmember Maxine Waters. We reached her in Miami yesterday just before she was going to a meeting with Haitians there. We asked her to talk about her first reaction and hearing of Father Jean-Just's arrest.
I called down to Ambassador Foley and tried to get him to get some U.N. troops or somebody over there to protect Father and so that they would not kill him. And then I wrote a letter to Colin Powell explaining the call that I had received describing the fact that these hooded men armed had surrounded the church and that they were going in to get him and said to him that I had asked for assistance from the ambassador, and I wanted him to investigate it right away and to do everything possible to protect the lives not only of Father John Juice, but other priests who I understand may have been attacked also.
We understand there are also three senators who are in a radio station who were arrested. What do you know about that?
Yeah, that's true. I got a call about that. They had been asked to come to the radio station, and they were there, and the same kind of attack with hooded individuals, armed, came and took them out and arrested them, and I think they let one person go, and there may be one or two others that they have kept jailed. So now you have in jail, you know, many of the persons who are members of Lavalas, who are well respected. You have Neptune, the Prime Minister. You have Soan, a beloved woman and artist. And you have now Father Jean Just, and you have the Think Two senators. This is awful. Aside from that, the killing and the mayhem that's going on down there. I am really asking Colin Powell to get involved. I also had a talk with one of the State Department spokespersons who had accused Lavalas of the problems in Haiti. And I called him and I said to him, this is absolutely unconscionable what you're doing. Not only did you have Guy Philippe and these armed terrorists running around threatening to kill President Aristide prior to the coup d'etat and taking over Ghana Eve and going into City Soleil and Bel Air and killing Lavalas members, I don't hear the outrage. I didn't hear the outrage. You have done nothing to disarm them. Now they're running around talking about they have reestablished the military and they're in charge and asking the government for 10 years back pay. They've got guns. They've got uniforms. And then you come out and accuse Lavalas of the problems when you have, you know, done nothing. I said, so I'm saying to the State Department, you have a responsibility to disarm those terrorists and to lock them up. That trial that you had for Louis Jodel Chamblain was a sham, and to allow that murderer to roam free, having been responsible for the Robitaille massacre, is just outrageous. So the State Department has been, you know, really partly responsible for what is going on there. And I'm trying to get them to understand there will be no stabilization in Haiti until President Aristide is returned to fill out his term.
And then if you could repeat on this issue, the issue of the attack on South African President Thabo Mbeki for allowing the Aristides to live in South Africa, saying that he is now promoting violence in Haiti.
Well, I think that Latatour's attack on Mbeki, President Mbeki, is typical of the outrageous kind of statements that he's been making since he's been placed there by the American government. This man is irresponsible. Don't forget that Latatour is the same one who called the terrorists, Guy Philippe and these gun thugs, freedom fighters. So, you know, whatever he says cannot be accepted in any shape, form, or fashion. President Mbeki should not be attacked. He should be thanked for helping to provide a safe haven for President Aristide. And to say that somehow he is responsible or that President Aristide is responsible for the violence that's going on in Haiti now is just, I mean, it is just illogical and untrue and outrageous. As a matter of fact, the destabilization of Haiti has been caused by the coup d'etat and the removal of Aristide. Again, it's just like Iraq. They didn't have any post-war planning. They removed him and they, you know, stayed there for a while with a few Marines. Then they turned it over to Brazilians who were trying to curry some favor with the United States up at the UN. And they left and left these poor people in the hands of thugs and terrorists and an incompetent person that they brought in from Boca Raton. And it is just outrageous what's going on.
U.S. Congressmember Maxine Waters speaking to us from Florida. When we come back, we'll speak with the attorney for Father Jean-Just, a prominent priest in Port-au-Prince who's just been arrested by the unelected La Tortue regime. We then will go to the issue of voting irregularities, voter suppression, election protection in this year's 2004 election right here in the United States. Stay with us. Sanyo here on Democracy Now!, the War and Peace Report, democracynow.org, broadcasting on more than 275 Pacifica and NPR radio stations, public access TV stations, PBS stations, and on both satellite networks, on Dish Network, Channel 9415, Free Speech TV, 9410 Link TV, which is also on Direct TV, Channel 375. And we are video and audio streaming at democracynow.org. If you'd like to get our headlines daily, you can sign up at our website. At democracynow.org. I'm Amy Goodman as we continue on the issue in Haiti right now with Bill Quigley, law professor at Loyola University in New Orleans, one of the attorneys on Father Gerard Jean-Just's legal team, joins us on the phone from Port-au-Prince, where he has recently visited Father Jean-Just in prison. Welcome to Democracy Now!
Thank you, Amy.
It's good to have you with us. Can you describe the conditions there, why Father Jean-Just was arrested?
Well, the exact reason why he was arrested, we don't know. There haven't been formal charges brought against him. He was arrested last Wednesday night, Wednesday afternoon, in the middle of feeding 600 children in his very, very poor parish in Port-au-Prince. The police came and infiltrated the crowd, and when people realized what was going on, they pushed the priest into the rectory and locked him in. And the police blasted out an iron-grated covering of a window and then smashed him and went in and got him. They accused him of helping the insurrection, aiding the uprising by funneling money and arms to terrorists. That's what they've said informally. As I said, there is no formal charge. They searched the rectory. They searched all the place around there. They had, again, heavily armed men that the people described were dressed as ninjas, that they had black things over their faces with only slits for their eyes, heavy weapons shooting into the neighborhood and the like. There's reports that three children were shot at the same time. Father Jean-Just was dragged, handcuffed, broken glass window, and into a car and put in jail, where he's been ever since. I visited him twice in jail. He's in a cell with 18 other people. They have a bucket in the corner to use for the bathroom. They have no beds. They have mice. It's very, very hot in Haiti right now, at least compared to New Orleans, and much, much hotter on the inside. But he's still in great spirits, and really trying to help the people in his parish, help the people in the country stand up for themselves and stand up for freedom.
We're speaking with Bill Quigley, who is the attorney for Father Gerard Jean-Juste. Right now, who do you appeal to?
Well, working with a very courageous Haitian lawyer, Mario Joseph, who is working with the Institute of Justice and Democracy in Haiti, and really just took the very first step yesterday, which was finally getting a judge to come to the prison to certify that Father Jean-Juste is in prison. So, you know, he's been in prison since Wednesday evening, and we're just at that point. And then it is to try to find a judge who will be willing to evaluate the evidence that's against Jean-Juste of whatever crime he's supposed to be accused of. But the Haitian legal system does not work very well in the best of times, and these are the worst of times. The lawyers have been told by judges that the orders have come down from the top, that this case is like the case of the prime minister who is in jail, the minister of the interior who is in jail, members of parliament who are in jail, that this is a case that's too political to go through the regular process. And so no hearing is planned, no trial is planned, no formal charges have been made. And I think that the idea is clearly just to keep him in prison and as long as they can. The people here think the hope of the country is that somehow there's going to be another president in the United States and that another president in the United States will help them try to restore democracy in this country. A person drove me yesterday and said, you know, 10 years ago or when the first coup happened, who was the president? Said, you know, this year when it happened, who was the president? Bush the Younger. And so the people very much still hopeful. Even Father Jean-Juste, he says repeatedly, he's a man of great faith, and he said, like the saints of Peter and Paul, my body is in jail, but my spirit is free. And so it's going to be very hard to keep this man in jail because it is a constant train of people coming to try and ask for his blessing. He's helping other prisoners who are in jail. He's in terrible conditions, but his spirit is very strong.
We're talking to Bill Quigley about the arrest and jailing under the La Tortue regime of Father Jean-Juste, a very popular priest in Port-au-Prince. During the coup 10 years ago, Father Jean-Juste was also in hiding, and I got to spend time in his church, a church where hundreds, thousands of people go in the nation's capital of Haiti. Lucy Tondreau is also on the line with us, Haitian community activist and South Florida. For years, she co-hosted a radio show with Father Jean-Juste that provided a forum for discussion between Haitians living abroad and those living in Haiti. There have been major protests on the arrest of Father Jean-Juste. Can you talk about them, Lucy?
Yes, good morning. The Haitian-American community here was very shocked to hear that Father Gerard Jean-Juste has been arrested. When the rumors started last Tuesday, we had the opportunity to have Father Jean-Juste live on the radio to explain to the community what was going on at that time. He told us that there were several trucks of masked men with heavy weapons surrounding the church, and we asked him what he was doing at that time. He said, as I usually do on Tuesdays and Sundays, I was distributing food. I am distributing food to the children. He said that since they were still outside, we're talking about the gunmen, he was not going to open his gates, and he was going to continue to feed the children that were at the presbytery at the time. 15 minutes later, we heard that they have invaded the presbytery, that Father Jean-Juste has been severely beaten and dragged to a car and forced to one of those police headquarters first in Delma and then in Pétionville. The Haitian American community from that day are demonstrating on a daily basis with pictures of Father Jean-Just. They have had several press conferences to let people know what is taking place, and they will continue to demonstrate until Father Jean-Just and other political prisoners are free.
Lucy Tandreau, as a Haitian American living here in the United States, being very connected to your own country, we hear obviously a lot more about what is going on in Iraq right now, although there was this coup that took place in Haiti. Can you talk about the government that is there now, the U.S. involvement in what transpired February, March of this year?
Well, first of all, we have to say that the U.S., along with the French government and the Canadian government, have done what we call a character assassination of President Jean-Bertrand Aristide that led to the coup d'etat and the kidnapping of a duly elected president. In Haiti, after I was in Haiti during the coup d'etat on February the 29th, we have seen stack of bodies at the general hospital, at the general morgue of Port-au-Prince. The repression is like outrageous. Gérard Latortue, they just are using him as a puppet to do the work, I believe, that Colin Powell and Condoleezza Rice have designed for Haiti. It is not by coincidence today, as Haiti is celebrating its 200th anniversary of independence, all these things are happening. In Gérard Latortue, according to the Haitian constitution, we said the people that are in Haiti right now, we cannot even call them government because they have violated all the clause and the articles of Haitian's constitution. Gérard Latortue, in order for him to be named prime minister, he would have to live in Haiti for 5 years. And we know that Mr. Latortue have been living in Boca Raton, Florida for the past 16 years. And never set foot in Haiti. The Constitution states that Mr. Boniface was supposed to, in case of presidential vacancy, he was supposed to be in power for a transitional period of 90 days. It's been 8 months since Mr. Boniface is in Haiti acting as the president of the country, which means today these people that are governing the country have no constitutional rights, they have no mandate from the Haitian population, and the people in Haiti, just as us abroad, are fighting and asking for the physical return of President Jean-Bertrand Aristide as the duly elected president of Haiti. The repression is very grave in Haiti at this time. They are arresting people left and right. They are killing the people in the slums from Bel Air and Cité Soleil in order to keep the people quiet and stop asking for the return of President Aristide.
Lucy Tandreau, I want to thank you for being with us from South Florida. Also, Bill Quigley, law professor at Loyola University in New Orleans, speaking to us from Port-au-Prince, one of the lawyers for now jailed priest, Father Gérard Jean-Just. This is Democracy Now! As we turn now to the elections here. Early voting for the presidential elections began in Florida on Monday as activists urged people to opt for early ballots to avoid a repeat of the 2000 election. Black and elderly voters in particular lined up to cast ballots 2 weeks before November 2nd. Computer problems and long lines soon emerged in Florida, one of the 32 states where voters are allowed to make their choice before Election Day. Across the country, independent poll watching groups are urging voters to take advantage of early voting to avoid problems. More than two dozen states offer no excuse early voting by either mail or in person, meaning voters don't have to give a reason for why they want to vote before November 2nd. Some states, such as Nevada, Iowa, West Virginia, have already begun. Texas, Arkansas, and Colorado also started on Monday. Today, we'll take a look at how voters in states across the country, how voting has been suppressed or voters harassed and intimidated in this lead up to the election. Some examples. This summer, Michigan State Rep John Papageorge was quoted in the Detroit Free Press as saying, "If we don't suppress the Detroit vote, we're going to have a tough time in this election." African Americans comprise 83% of Detroit's population. In South Dakota's June 2004 primary, Native American voters were prevented from voting after they were challenged to provide photo ID, which they were not required to present under state or federal law. In Kentucky, July 2004, Black Republican officials joined to ask their state GOP party chair to renounce plans to place vote challengers in African-American precincts during the coming election. Just a few of the examples of problems in these last months. Elliot Mintzberg is with us, legal director of People for the American Way Foundation. People for the American Way just released a report in cooperation with the NAACP called The Long Shadow of Jim Crow, Voter Intimidation and Suppression in America. They have monitors deployed across the country. Can you start, Elliot Mintzberg, by telling us what you found?
Well, as you've indicated, what we have found is that unfortunately in just about every election beginning early in the 20th century, there have been attempts to suppress or intimidate voters. And for the most part, those tend to be minority voters, African-American or Hispanic or other minorities, where someone thinks that they will get an electoral advantage by doing that. We've seen it, as you said, as recently as this year and as far back as in the 50s and 60s. And of course, before that, I don't have to remind your listeners, voting was indeed not even permitted among many minorities effectively in many parts of the country.
Can you talk about what you're doing right now around the country?
Well, we, People for the American Way Foundation, the NAACP, the Lawyers Committee for Civil Rights, Working Assets, many others have combined to form an election protection program. And that program tries to offer three levels of protection to voters on Election Day, not just for intimidation efforts, but also for just the typical routine but very problematic issues that may occur at the polls when people try to vote but are not able to do it for one reason or another. The program will involve more than 20,000 poll monitors at precincts across the country in primarily heavily minority precincts. It will involve lawyers and others standing by in 50-some locations across the country, and it will involve a national toll-free hotline, 1-866-OUR-VOTE, that voters anywhere can call if there are problems either in terms of suppression or intimidation or just people being able to cast their vote. The idea of this program is to, frankly, restore the democracy that many feel was lost as a result of the problems in the 2000 election, to let people be involved in that, because we have literally thousands and thousands of volunteers that are involved in it, and to try to encourage people to get out there and vote, to cast a ballot that counts, because if you need help, there'll be somebody there to help out.
People for the American Way Foundation President Ralph Neese says new revelations from a smoking email about Governor Bush's involvement in the attempt to implementation of a voter purge list in Florida demand the appointment of a special counsel by the Attorney General John Ashcroft. Can you explain further?
Sure can. As many people know, one of the great tragedies of the 2000 election was that thousands of people, primarily minorities, were thrown off the rolls in Florida because of an alleged felon purge, an attempt to eliminate people who had committed felonies from the ballot. Florida is one of the only six states in the country that doesn't automatically restore voting rights. The problem was that they did it through a series of lists that were fatally flawed and threw off people who shouldn't have been thrown off the rolls. Well, this year there was an attempt to do that again. This time around, public interest groups like ours and the media demanded and eventually went to court and got a copy of the state's list and showed that the list was incredibly flawed again. It significantly overrepresented African Americans, and it had a lot of people on it who'd been granted clemency. Faced with these embarrassing disclosures, the state sometime in July or August withdrew the list. But what the smoking email demonstrates is that way back in May, before the state began to order the implementation of this program, there was apparently a discussion with state officials and directly with Governor Bush, where state officials said to the governor that there were some serious problems in that list, and the governor, according to this email, directed that they go ahead and implement the list anyway. They did implement it. They tried to keep it secret. The rest, of course, was history. From our perspective, this is a serious potential violation, and does require, in our view, the federal government to investigate possible attempts to violate people's civil rights, and particularly in light of the fact that we're talking about the president's brother, ought to involve the appointment of a special prosecutor. Unfortunately, we've heard nothing from the Justice Department on that so far.
We're talking to Elliot Mintzberg, legal director of People for the American Way Foundation, which is part of the Election Protection Coalition, a voter education, empowerment, and protection initiative, active in a number of lawsuits challenging decisions made by Florida officials that disadvantage Florida voters. When we come back, we're going to stay in Florida, talk about what is happening there. We're also going to be talking about a threat that the head of the Republican National Committee made to rock the vote, telling them to cease and desist talking about the possibility of a draft. Stay with us.
That's why I'm choosing one minute to vote for which piece instead of war. My vote makes things right. Everybody's moving around, yeah. For liberty on Tuesday, we sing the sound, oh yeah. Head into my voting booth, oh, yeah. I am the youth, and I care about life. That's why I'm singing, choosing one leader to vote for, yeah. Which peace instead of war, yeah. Makes things right. Out of my house, a rush to the bus stop. I found a way to make the war stop.
Oh yeah.
Head into my ethical culture.
Kale Aloha, voting booth. Premiering this nationally. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. As we talk about election protection initiatives around the country and what is happening. Yes, voting has started in many states around the country, early voting. Our guests are Elliot Mintzberg of the People for the American Way Foundation, also Joe Egan on the line with us, an Orlando-based attorney representing a number of people and groups who've been harassed for conducting voter registration activities. Joe Egan, tell us what you have found in Orlando.
Well, I represent an organization that's been around since the 50s. It's largely an African-American organization made up mostly of elderly, by elderly, I'm talking about retired African-Americans who volunteer their time doing voter registration, get out the vote effort, including absentee ballots in their. And they became the target of an FDLE, the Florida Department of Law Enforcement investigation, about 2.5-3 months ago. It's an interesting, it ties into the comments made a few minutes ago regarding the felony list, because the same organization, it's an organization, the FDLE is a state law enforcement agency, the head of which reports directly to Jeb Bush, the governor, and the head of which is appointed by, of course, the governor, Jeb Bush. And what they did, under the guise of investigating election fraud issues, they did a two-prong attack, we believe, on this organization and on its efforts. The first thing they did is they launched a press campaign, much of it really privately, doing private press briefings, background, I guess, briefings they call it. And they made a number of public statements saying that there was racketeering involved and they were investigating racketeering, etc. This was done before there was any investigation. This was before they had gathered any evidence. Then they randomly selected African Americans, mostly elderly, who had voted absentee ballot with the assistance of the Voters League, and they made unannounced visits to their home. And the unannounced visits were made by not one, but by groups of armed law enforcement officers. And that what I've said so far is not disputed. What's disputed apparently down here is whether or not it was intentional or just simply reckless. What also is not disputed is the fact that it has resulted in a great deal of uncertainty on the part of many people about the legality of voting by absentee ballot. It's also intimidated a great many people. There are people who, again, these are mostly elderly African Americans. Some might be handicapped, but most of them are elderly people in their 70s and 80s who use the Voters League volunteers. And a lot of them just will not participate anymore. And that's what prompted us to go this issue.
Can you talk about the 73-year-old African-American who has been long involved with voter registration and election issues, who has been targeted recently?
Well, Ezzie Thomas is I think, who you're talking about. He's the president. He's a small businessman who was raised in Orlando and has carried on an absentee ballot program here for about, since he retired, for about 8 years, along with voter registration, voter education. He speaks to neighborhood groups, high schools, and it's all part of this campaign that they do to try to encourage minority participation in politics. What the FDLE has done and what the state attorney has done is taken a statute that's been on the books for a number of years, since 1998, and given an interpretation that is new, a very novel interpretation from a very ambiguous statute. And they are, they've effectively told him he's facing potential third-degree felony charges. Among other things, they're asking about whether stamps are provided to some of these absentee ballot voters. What's significant about this and about these allegations is, one, they are new, and two, what they're investigating is conduct that was largely evolved from Republican campaign efforts down here for years. And the Voters League copied, really, what the Republican Party has done. That is, run these absentee ballot campaigns using volunteers and paying expenses for some of the volunteers to buy gas, but also providing stamps and so forth. And so, you know, the Voters League, and Ezzie Thomas, of course, is in a position where they're asking, why me, why now? But it is effectively shut down. The bottom line is it's effectively shut down the much of the outreach by the Voters League in this election. We've got volunteers who are just afraid to go out on the street. They've had home visits themselves. Some of them, some of the younger ones, and people in their 60s who are still working, had state law enforcement officers show up at their place of employment and interrogate them. And they simply will not, they're scared to death. They don't want to do any more volunteer work in this election issue. It's it's caused a real split in the community down here. The newspaper down here, the editors and all, were outraged by the allegations, thinking that Orlando is perhaps being painted as a remnant of the, I guess what was called a few minutes ago, is the Jim Crow era. But for a great many people who have, especially people that were around in the 50s and 60s, this conduct is reminiscent of the sort of voter suppression that went on in the past. And what's important, I think what's significant about it, is that there really is no dispute as to the facts. I think the only dispute down here right now is whether or not it was part of a conspiracy or whether it was intentional. But there's no dispute that the conduct did occur, that it was unprecedented, that the FDLE had never done an investigation like this before, because the visits to those homes were the homes of innocent people, people which they admit were not involved in any criminal conduct at all. And the outcome, of course, that is people being intimidated by having armed law enforcement officers show up at their front door, and elderly people being confused about when they're told at the interrogation at their front door and in their houses that you're involved in a criminal investigation because you voted absentee ballot. I don't think there's any dispute that some of those people are convinced that absentee ballot voting, either one, is illegal, or two, brings the man to the door, that is the law enforcement agency. And it's it has really caused some alarm down here. And of course, the organization I represent, the Voters League, has been devastated by it. You know, they've seen years of hard work simply go down the drain over this thing. We estimate we've lost probably at least 1,000 voters who may not vote this time because of the home visits and the concurrent active media campaign run by the FDLE, which put out, we believe, a lot of misleading information suggesting that there was some sort of wide-scale criminal conduct on the part of these volunteers, all of which now, of course, there's no evidence of that.
Joe Egan, I want to bring in Jemu Green, who is president of Rock the Vote. Jemu, can you describe your organization then, what happened with this letter you got from the head of the Republican National Committee, Gillespie?
Good morning, Amy. Thank you for having us. Well, you know, the draft is a live wire issue for young voters right now, and Rock the Vote street teams are, you know, young people across the country are talking to us about how students and young voters are talking about the draft. We have been working on this campaign for several months to just bring to attention of both candidates, both to, you know, all of the candidates running for Congress, how important this issue is to this generation and that they deserve an honest debate. Unfortunately, after we put out a campaign over our website and had a number of public service announcements running, the chair of the Republican National Committee decided that this was not an issue that was relevant for young people. This was not an issue that he thought should be discussed, and has asked Rock the Vote to cease and desist. But talking to an organization that was founded on freedom of expression and telling them to shut up, basically, is not something that's going to work, especially with this generation, especially with an issue that is, you know, so top of mind and so important to the young people who are seeing the war against terror being fought out, you know, on television and, of course, seeing it on the front lines.
Are you afraid of being legally threatened?
We are absolutely assured that we are operating within the bounds of our 501c3 status. You know, there are a number of issues that we have been talking about all year, not just the war and the possibility of a military draft, but young people's need for health care and the financial stress that this generation is under because of the rising cost of college tuition, the, you know, amount of debt that college students are graduating with. And the draft is one of a set of issues we have been, you know, really highlighting for the candidates and highlighting to this generation as, you know, these are the decisions that are going to be made by the people who are elected to office. And we need them to have an honest debate on all of these issues. This is not something that we're concerned about is going to, you know, put the organization in jeopardy, because at the end of the day, we are just saying to the candidates, talk to this generation, talk to us about the issues we care about.
We're also joined on the phone by Janet Ryder, the Philadelphia Voter Protection Coordinator of the AFL-CIO. What are you seeing there?
Well, here in Philadelphia, I don't see as extreme things I'm hearing on the phone. I'm absolutely appalled at the whole thing. Here in Philadelphia, during the last election, there were people that intimidated voters, and they rode around in dark cars in the middle of the minority community, white males in dark cars and dark suits, and they looked intimidating. It looked as though they were the police officers. And they wore badges that were not legal and intimidated voters by telling them if they hadn't paid their child support, they wouldn't be able to vote. Or they held up the process by questioning people in line as to their identity so they wouldn't be able to vote as well. So we've been doing a campaign to educate new voters, because we have more than 100,000 absolutely new voters who will need to have identification at the polls on Election Day. And hopefully they will bring that identification with them and we won't have that problem. We plan on having attorneys at the polling sites that we think will be most troublesome. And in the city of Philadelphia and the outlying areas, we have a lot of polling sites where it's predominantly minority voters come to vote. So we plan on having attorneys at those sites to make sure that their legal rights are not violated.
I wanted to go back to Elliot Mintzberg of the People for the American Way Foundation. Can you talk about what's happened in both Nevada and Oregon, same organization having to do with registration drive and getting rid of certain registration forms?
It's very troubling. The reports are that an organization that has been funded by the Republican National Committee to conduct voter registration, that those organizations that organization has collected registration forms, and someone in the office has torn up registration forms where people chose to register as Democrats rather than as Republicans. And this information comes from people who have worked for the organizations and whose conscience led them to report this to the authorities. It's a very serious and very troubling allegation.
Now, this is in both Oregon and Nevada?
That's right.
And it was reported by a previous employee who watched a supervisor rip up in the case of Nevada?
That's exactly right. And in fact, one news station in Nevada actually showed film of the ripped up ballots. Apparently, the person brought them to the news station before he brought them to the FBI.
And so what happens in this case?
Well, there is criminal investigation going on right now. One of the big problems is, how do these voters get a chance to vote? And we and a lot of other organizations have put the word out in Nevada and Oregon, if anybody thinks that they registered with one of those organizations, to please call that 1-866-OUR-VOTE hotline and let people know. There is actually a procedure in Nevada that may be able to be used to get people like that who signed such a registration form on time, but then had it torn up, to be able to get a chance to vote, but only if they are able to report that before Election Day.
Mm. Joe Egan, what about the firefighters?
Well, that was that popped up in the middle of this. The same organization again, the FDLE, the State Law Enforcement Agency under Governor.
We're talking Florida now.
We are. They're an organization that for years has endorsed mostly Republicans down here. And for the first time in, I think, probably 20 years, they endorsed John Kerry. And 3 weeks after that, they were hit with an FDLE investigation, highly publicized TV cameras, everything else showing up. And the interrogation was into their use of what they call union leave bank time. It's a provision that is very common in police and fire department unions around the country. And it allows the union to take its members off duty to engage in union activity. And the union is the sole decision maker as to how that time will be used, whether they want to use it for grievances or negotiations or for political activity.
We just have 30 seconds.
Well, down here, it's been in the place since 1984, and it had never been contested before. And for FDLE jumped in, engaged in this campaign with the press, and scared the heck out of people, hauled up in front of the state's attorney's office under subpoena, the kind of perv walks with the cameras and all, and then immediately after about a month dropped the investigation, finding no violation. Of course, there was no violation going into it. I mean, the law was very clear going into that inquiry, as it was coming out of the inquiry. But again, you know, with that organization, those officers and those members are largely silent. I mean, they are scared to death to engage in the usual political activities.
On that note, we have to leave it there. The show has come to an end. Joe Egan, thanks for joining us. Janet Ryder of Philadelphia Voter Protection Coordinator, AFL-CIO. Jemu Green, president of Rock the Vote. And thank you to Elliot Mintzberg of People for the American Way Foundation. We will continue to follow this issue of voter suppression in the lead up to this election. That does it for the show, Democracy Now!, produced by Mike Berkshire, Fabdo Kadusa, and Nagar Elizabeth Press, John Hamilton, and a very special happy birthday to Jeremy Scahill. Yesterday, he hit 30. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for joining us.
Well, that's right.